I promised this morning that I was going to have something to say about the wasteland and the Grail legend. And this is not going to be an easy thing to present. The wasteland of T.S. Eliot refers his theme to Jesse Weston's famous book from way, way back in the early 20s, From Ritual to Romance, where she shows that the Grail legend, and indeed all of the Arthurian legends, but particularly the Grail, have derived from Celtic mythologies, which became associated in the period of the Roman occupation of Britain with mystery cult themes. And although there has been a good deal of challenging of this theory of hers, the challenges are not really too serious. The theory has to be modified a little bit here and there, but essentially this is correct. The knights and ladies of the Arthurian romances are indeed Celtic gods and goddesses masquerading in human costume. And this is one way of saying that in all of us, in our human activities, deities are operating. This was the intention. Now, the particular theme of the Grail story is one of enchantment and disenchantment. This is a very well-known motif. There are some beautiful examples in the Arabian Nights. One that I can recommend as very close in sentiment to the Grail story is Judar and his brothers. This is a dandy story, and it will show that this theme of enchantment and disenchantment is not simply peculiar to the Arthurian system. In fact, the tales of the Arabian Nights and the tales of the Arthurian romances are in many cases exact contemporaries. And as you know, these two worlds of the Muslims and the medieval Christian knights and all were in very intimate interplay, not only in the Holy Land at the time and in the place of the Crusades, but also in Spain, where the Christians were trying to recover Spain, which they had lost 711 to the Muslims, which they did not completely recover until 1492. The whole of the Middle Ages in Spain is one of interplay between the Muslim and Christian world. And finally, in Italy and southern Italy and Sicily, in the court particularly of Frederick II, we have a very strong communication between these two worlds. So not only the knightly activities and the social contacts, nor simply the theological, but also the philosophical and popular story worlds are very closely united. One of the strongest influences, of course, is that of the Sufis and the Persian poets and the Muslim poets in Spain on the troubadour tradition, which I may have to be able to talk about tomorrow. The idea of the enchantment and disenchantment is that people at a certain time and place are forced to perceive the world in a way that is inadequate or improper to its character. This makes me think of the Gnostic aphorism in the Gospel according to Thomas, where, and I've already mentioned this once before, Christ is asked when the kingdom will come. And Christ says it will not come by expectation. It is here now. The kingdom of the Father is spread over the earth, and men do not see it. Men do not see it because of an enchantment of their eyes. The word of the Savior would be the disenchanting factor. So in these legends, the Savior, who is to disenchant the world, is the equivalent of the Christ figure or the Savior figure who opens men's eyes, or in the Oriental tradition of the Buddhism, to the Buddha who releases you from the enchantment of Maya. And the enchantment of Maya in modern psychological terms is exactly that image of the world that you have as a consequence of the desire and fear systems of your own life mode. If you could break that, break away from your ego limitation, you would behold the world of paradise right here, now. There is a Buddhist saying, this world, with all its ills, with all its horrors, with all its stupidities, with all its darkness, is the golden lotus world, is the golden lotus world right now as it is. And if you cannot see it as such, this is not the world's fault. What is to be corrected is not the world, but your own perspective. And so we must expect to find in the Grail legend that everything is all there, only it is not being seen. And what the hero is to do is to clarify the situation. Now, what has brought about the enchantment in the Grail legend? There are two factors in the legend as it is communicated to us by Wolfram von Eschenbach in his Parsifal, composed about 1210 to 1215. There's an earlier Parsifal by Chrétien of Troyes, which, however, is incomplete. Chrétien's Parsifal is perhaps 1190 or something like that. The theme was not congenial to Chrétien. Chrétien was extremely fluent, graceful, lovely, fabulous. He could write, as one German commentator says, he could jingle rhymes from his sleeve like a magician. They just come rippling, running out, and I'll be speaking of him a little later, perhaps, in some of his other romances, The Lancelot and The Yvain, is far more successful than in The Percival. It was Wolfram von Eschenbach who picked up the theme and declares in his preface and in his conclusion that Chrétien had misrepresented it. He developed it in full, and this is the great Parsifal which Wagner took over and, I would say, in a certain way, destroyed. And I'll explain why a little later. Now, according to Wolfram, who really knew what he was talking about, the reason for the enchantment was that the Grail King had been very severely wounded by a pagan lance. Now, the character of the Grail King is the crux of this whole situation. This was a young man, the Grail King, who had inherited his role. He had not earned it. He was simply anointed as king. The whole problem in the Middle Ages was that the religious life was under the control of the anointed. The salvation of man was through the sacraments, which were handed down through anointed clergy. And whether you were a person of great, majestic spirituality or very trivial character who had made a good confession, you would nevertheless be saved through the ritual magic of the sacraments. You might ask, why should anyone go in quest of the Grail in the Middle Ages when the holy sacrifice of the Mass was being celebrated all around him every day, all the time, and all he had to do was go around the corner, and there was Christ himself in the sacrament of the altar? What more do you want? Well, the point is that the sacrament of the altar was simply sacramental and ritual, and the Grail Castle is achieved by one who is worthy of it. A person unworthy, no matter how okay sacramentally, and true contrition and perfect confessions and Holy Communion and all that, he's ineligible for it. But as we'll see later, the Grail Castle was entered not only by the Grail hero, but also by his Muslim half-brother. So you didn't have to be a baptized Christian to go to the Grail Castle. In Wolfram's context, it is the majesty of spirit that counts. Now, the character of an enchantment is that there are people all around who know the rules of the enchantment. These are the people of the Grail Castle community. But they can't dispel it. The only way the enchantment can be dispelled is by some naive person doing the thing that has to be done unintentionally, out of his nature. To do it intentionally will not break the spell. So you get the point. The rescue of the world is to be through an intrinsic nobility of nature, which is expressed through the hero. The hero, in this tradition, is called the great fool. He is one who is uninstructed in the secret of the enchantment, and nevertheless, because of the purity, and I don't mean purity in the Galahad sense at all, but the integrity and honesty and courage and forthrightness of his nature, is able to restore the proper natural order as against the enforced social order of the anointments. Now here was a king, the Grail King, who was not naturally competent for his job. He had been anointed. No sooner anointed than, as a young man, and properly in the way of young men, he was interested in the adventure of love. So the Grail King, who represents the champion, the guardian of the highest spiritual symbol, goes forth in quest of love with the war cry, Amor. And he encounters on the way a natural man, a pagan, who represents the natural principle, in quest of the Grail. And these two encounter, one being a Christian and the other a Muslim, they immediately go into a combat. And what happens is that the Moor, the Muslim, sends his lance through the genitals of the king so that he is rendered impotent. That is the symbol of the wasteland. The king who represents its fertilization, its spiritual fertilization, is symbolically rendered impotent. And that king at the same time with his blow slays the Muslim. So, as a result of the fact that the Lord of the Spirit is inadequate to his function, both the world of the Spirit and the world of nature are knocked down, rendered impotent, and that's the wasteland situation. A pall falls over the Grail Castle. The king is carried, he manages to get home, and he is in terrific anguish. And when the head of the lance is extracted from the wound, the name of the Grail is seen written on it. This Muslim was in quest of the Grail. What you have here is spirit in quest of nature, nature in quest of spirit, and neither helping the other, but in collision with each other. What we've got to do now is unite the two. There is another enchantment in this same story of Wolfram, which runs parallel to the enchantment of the Grail Castle. This is the enchantment of the Castle of Marvels. This has to do not with the realm of the spirit, but with the realm of love, and let's say physical love, erotics. It has to do with the world of the troubadour love. The story is of a very powerful and well-known and distinguished duke who falls in love with the wife of a noble king of Sicily, who would be probably Frederick II. And in the way of 12th century troubadour love, he becomes the lover of the king's wife. But when the king discovers the two together, the king castrates this man, who is so mortified by this, as well as physically stricken, that he decides on revenge. He goes to Persia and learns tremendously powerful magic. And then he comes back and enchants the whole aristocracy of Europe in a castle known as the Castle of Marvels. All the queens and countesses and everybody else and beautiful women are there, and all the glorious knights and all, completely separated from each other, even forgetting who they are. So we have the Castle of Marvels enchanted over here. That represents the sort of wasteland of love, which I spoke of earlier in connection with the Tristan story, and the Castle of the Grail here, the wasteland of the spiritual life, both the spiritual and the secular worlds of spiritual experience. Love and beauty are under this pall of enchantment through these two castrati. The Klingsor is the name of the one who puts the Castle of Marvels enchantment, and the poor old King Amfortas, young King Amfortas, is the stricken Grail King. You see your Wagner here already. That's the situation. That's what has to be healed. And there are two heroes available, one for each task. One hero is Parsifal, who is a young, callow, great fool indeed. And the other, graceful, courteous, lovely Gawain, who is a highly sophisticated philanderer. The love stories, the funny adventures are absolutely beyond belief, that Wolfram manages to present for Gawain as he goes from one to another of these experiences of his, in and out of bed and in and out of battlefields, and all of it going along in grand style. But that all represents part of the enchantment situation. Now, I'll deal first with Parsifal to show something of the sorts of adventure that lead to the release of the enchantment. His father had been killed in courtly combat, and his mother, sick and tired of the whole courtly game, had gone into the forest and had given birth to her child in the forest in a kind of hermitage, and had told her servants never even to mention the world of courtly life to her son. So he grows up as a kind of country bumpkin of glorious beauty. I guess he's something like about 15 or 16 when one day, rambling around the hills, he hears the clatter of hoofs. He's never heard hoofs before. His mother has told him about religion. His mother has told him that God is good and the devil is bad, and he should look out for devils and always be for God. In other words, he is given instruction. The instruction, the normal family instruction about religion that many of us have had. When he sees these shining knights come along, three of them, he thinks they are angels. And so he kneels down and prays to them. And the leader, a great duke in a glorious armor with bangles and everything else, he says, "Young man, I am no angel, I am a knight." Now, in the romantic view of the Middle Ages, this awakens in him his noble nature. He has inherited the knightly character of his wonderful knightly father, and even though ignorant of it and living under an illusion, he has been awakened. Now, this is the counterpart of the call to adventure that I mentioned yesterday. The hero is called to adventure. There is a call. And so he says, "What is a knight?" And he's told what a knight is, and that if he would go to Arthur's court, he would be made a knight. That's where knights are made. So he determines to go to Arthur's court. He goes back to his mother to say, "I want to be a knight," and she faints. Then she determines to make him look like a jackass and send him off to the court so that they'll immediately send him home. So she gets the worst horse she can find, and he picks up a little bunch of javelins that he has fashioned for himself, and she makes a costume for him where the shirt and the pants are all one thing, the sort of thing that fools wear, the costume of a fool, and she sends him forth in this brig to Arthur's court. And she gives him certain advice again. Don't cross streams where the water is deep. When you see a fine, beautiful woman, try to acquire a kiss from her and a ring. And with a few little details like that to give him instruction for life, he starts out. And here he's trotting along, and his mother follows him down the road, and when he passes out of sight, she drops dead. So he's killed his mother, and he didn't mean that either. He's going to go through for a long way just being the one that knocks things over. He comes to a stream, as Wolfram says, a stream that a rooster could have crossed. But on this horse, with his mother's instruction, he goes along the stream until he finds a place where there's almost no water at all. Then he goes across. The first thing he sees is a tent on a field, beautiful tent. So he drives to the tent, he moves in, and what, behold, does he see? A beautiful girl lying asleep on a bed with the covers way down to her waist. And Wolfram said, and God had made that body. And when he saw it, he noticed that there was a ring on his finger. So this lout jumps on the bed, and the woman wakes up with him trying to get a kiss from her and drag the ring from her finger and so forth. And it's that way he goes through life. Then when her husband comes back and finds the ruin in the place, he says, what's been going on? He thinks his honor has been destroyed. The boy wouldn't have known how to destroy his honor. And he tears the clothes of his wife to shreds and sits her on a horse, and they ride off together, and he's going to look for that guy, and until he finds him, so that's, the boy hasn't gone one half day, and he's got a major knight of the Arthurian court after him with his wife in distress and everything going to pieces. He arrives in the court, and he sees a knight in red armor with a golden goblet riding out. And the knight says, you tell Arthur when you go in, when he sees this silly fellow, that I'm waiting out in the field. Well, what had happened had been, this was a knight who had felt that Arthur owed him some land. Arthur had taken some land. So he'd gone in and insulted the court by taking the queen's cup and dashing the wine in her face, riding out and saying, who in this court is going to avenge the queen? This is just one way to provoke a knightly combat. Knightly combat is always engaged in according to the rules. So in goes this lout. He rides into the court, and he sees Arthur. He says, who's Arthur? He finds Arthur, and he says, make me a knight. Arthur said, Arthur was baffled, and Kay, who's a tough guy in the court, he says, send him out to deal with the Red Knight. All right, the kid turns around, goes out. The Red Knight, he comes riding at him in this silly horse with without any lance or anything else, just a packet of javelins. The knight won't even deign to use his lance on him, but turns it around the butt end and gives him a bash with it. The horse falls down, and the kid's on the ground, but he picks up a javelin and tosses it right through the knight's visor and it goes right into his head, and the knight drops dead. This is altogether against knightly rules, so the court has actually been greatly, scandalized by this whole thing. They come out to find what's going on out there, and they see this kid dragging the knight around trying to find how to get the armor off. One of the pages helps him get the armor off, shows him how to put it on, but the kid won't take off the clothes underneath. He's got the fool's costume underneath. And he inherits this mighty charger of this knight. He jumps on the darn thing, and he rides at a gallop for the whole day because he doesn't know how to stop the horse. The horse pulls him up at a castle where a magnificent knight receives him. And when they take his armor off, as they always do, they're appalled by what they see here. And of course, the symbol is he's still carrying his mother with him all the time, the clothes his mother made, and we're going to try to make him a knight. And this knight sees what a beautiful boy he is, and the knight has an available daughter here, and he's trying to put things together. You know, men were a little scarcer in those days than they are now, and this all looks like a very good match. So he's perfectly willing to give the boy instructions in knightly arms and so forth, which the kid has a great talent for. And the kid always talks about his mother, so the man says, why don't you grow up and quit talking about your mother and just become a knight according to these rules. Now, one of the great rules that he tells him, and this is the key rule to the failure of the knight when he comes to the castle for the first time, is don't ask too many questions. Be polite. Let people tell you things. Don't be over-curious. He offers him his daughter. The boy has this feeling now, here's this knightly feeling, the sound thing. I shouldn't marry someone who's just given to me. I must earn my wife. I must earn my life. So, to the man's great sorrow, he rides away, and he's on adventure. The horse takes him to a castle. I won't describe it how it is. It's a castle in very bad case. And it is being besieged by a king who has taken all the lands away from this orphan countess, who is the Châtelaine, the woman whose castle it is. He wants to marry her by force. Now, here again is the medieval social marriage. She was a good match, or at least he had the lands he wanted, and this marriage had come about. But she had sworn that she would not marry anyone except for love. Now, she represents the feminine end of this adventure. She has the integrity not to acquiesce in anything that does not accord with the dictates of her heart. The boy, Parsifal, is questing for his destiny. She is waiting for hers, and she knows when it isn't there. In other words, the refusal of suitors motif that I've already mentioned here. Well, it's a darling scene. These two kids, they're about 16 years old, and they've never known anything of anything. And he comes in, and he doesn't say a thing. They take the armor off and put him in nice silken garments and all, and he just sits mute. And she thinks, what a funny fellow. He'd been told not to ask any questions. So she thinks, well, perhaps I'll ask a question. So she asks him who he is and so forth. And presently, he goes to bed. He wakes up in the middle of the night to find her on her knees beside him in her nightgown, as Wolfram says in Gear for War. And he says, don't kneel to me, kneel to God. Well, she says, I'll get out of the bed if you want to be here, and I'll go over there. No, she says, you stay in the bed, and if you'll promise not to wrestle with me, I'll get in there with you. That's exactly what she said. And he didn't know anything about wrestling anyhow, and so in she gets. And then she tells him her story of how the knight has come to take her land, but she would rather throw herself from the castle tower than submit her body to someone she did not love. And he said, well, here he is, I'll kill the knight for you tomorrow. So, indeed he did. He gets on that prodigious horse, and he's been taught now by a master knight how to use his weapons. Out he goes, and this invincible one of the great kings of the world, is knocked down. Well, he has been told that when a man submits to you, you don't kill him. So when he's got him down, the knight submits. He says, I submit. And Parsifal says, okay, well, you just go into the town there and you become the servant of this girl. Her name is Conduire Amour, the one who conducts love, Conduire Amour, the one who guides love. Well, he said, if I went in there, they'd murder me. Well, then, says Parsifal, you go to King Arthur's court and submit yourself there to a certain lady whom he named. So this great, great knight goes. One after another, knights are being sent to Arthur's court by this lout that went out, and the court begins to think, this is somebody worth a place here. The next night, the girl then comes and receives him and says, This is my beloved, and I am his wife. He is lord of the castle. This is marriage out of love, and it constitutes a marriage. There is no priest involved in this at all. She puts her hair up as a married woman. They go to bed a second night together, and it's still a marriage simply of souls. Then the third night, something nice happens. Wolfram says, please excuse me for mentioning it, but he touched her, he found it nice, they interlaced arms and legs, and from that time on, that's how it was. And they thought, this is what we should have been doing all the while. But the point here is that the marriage, just the opposite to that of the other courts, was a spiritual marriage first, and actually a marriage out of love and not out of social for social purposes, and then gradually the physical thing comes in as the consummation of a marriage that had already been consummated in the spirit. This is Wolfram's approach to these matters. So now he's married, and for a while he's lord of the castle, and then he thinks, you know, he's done this. He's the great knight. He's the greatest knight in the whole world. He thinks, I wonder how mother is these days. He doesn't know that she dropped dead when he left. So he starts out to find mother. He has accomplished the worldly adventure perfectly. Out of his own spirit, he has caused a lot of trouble, but he has surpassed that in his positive deeds. And it's a man in that position, not one who has retreated from the ways of the world, but has mastered them fully, who is eligible for the next adventure, the adventure of the Grail. And the Grail castle appears to him as he starts out in quest of his mother. What he actually finds is the castle of the Grail. Now, this is a very interesting adventure of the Grail castle. The Grail castle is not a church. It's a castle. This is not a priestly, it's an aristocratic affair. The carrier of the Grail is not a male, is not a priest. It's an absolutely perfectly chaste virgin. And she is accompanied by a little company of virgins. So that the people performing the functions are people properly eligible for them in this tradition, which is exactly the opposite to what Wolfram saw in the church. The scandals of the clergy in the 12th century were perfectly well known to everybody. Saints and everybody else were complaining about the way the clergy was behaving. And Pope Innocent III called them a sty of pigs. So there was a certain reason for a challenge to all this. Here is the way the adventure of the Grail Castle begins. This knight is trotting along. By the way, he always lets the horse guide him. He never guides the horse. The horse represents the dynamics of the unconscious, of the psyche, of the nature, and the conscious guide is acquiescing in whatever the horse did, and it's the horse that carried him all to the proper castles all the way. He comes to a pond, and this is the very famous motif of the Fisher King. He comes to a pond where two men are in a boat, fishing. When you look at the Orphic imagery of the Orphic tradition, Orpheus is the fisher. Christ made his apostles fishers of men. The ring worn by the Pope is called the fisherman's ring. I shall make you fishers of men. It is the spiritual principle going down into the unconscious waters to pull souls or beings out of the unconscious state into the realm of the light. So here is the Fisher King. He is the maimed king. He is exactly the Grail King who I've already spoken about, who has been maimed. He cannot walk. He is in great pain, and he simply, this is the only thing he can do, is sit in a boat fishing. Christ, the maimed king, fishing for us all. The boy asks where he could spend the night, and the king says, There's a castle up the way, but don't get lost. A lot of people get lost. And he tells them how to get there, and you call, and they'll let down the gate. So it happens. The boy is received. And then he's ushered into a vast hall with hundreds of knights in it, and there is the Fisher King, who had been in the boat, brought in on a litter for the ceremony of the Grail. It was a scene of great anguish. Well, I don't want to go through the whole ceremony. It's gorgeously rendered. The girls carrying the Grail are clothed in garments that suggest the world of nature. Brown and green and the blue of the sky and all, they are nymphs, as it were, incarnating the powers of the natural world, and the Grail that they carry is a stone. Wolfram's Grail is a stone. There is a carved stone, a kind of jewel-like stone, that may have been the model for this, but it is always represented as a stone, and that stone is given the name of the Philosopher's Stone. Now, the Philosopher's Stone is that alchemical marvel which can transmute gross into subtle matter, can transmute primal filth into gold. It can transmute the life of the world into the golden life of the spirit. That's what the Grail can do. Furthermore, it is a vessel, as it were, that will give to everyone what he asks for. It is the inexhaustible vessel of plenty, which is the symbol of that spiritual conduit that carries the inexhaustible of the eternal into the inexhaustible forms of temporal world. There is a sloka in one of the Upanishads that says, from that inexhaustible, this inexhaustible, and that one is not tapped even. It cannot be exhausted, and the Grail is the source through which this comes. So there's a wonderful feast provided by the Grail, everyone receiving just what he wants. The king is very gracious to the boy, and now comes the main point. The boy's nature moves him to ask, what is wrong here? What is the cause of the sorrow of the king? If he had asked that question, the king would have been healed. But he remembers his instruction, don't ask any questions. And so the motive of sympathy or compassion is occluded, is cut out because of his ambition to be a proper knight. For the first time, this youth acts not according to his nature, but according to his ambition and the rules for that ambition. So he fails in the Grail quest. Everyone is very polite to him. He goes to his room. When he wakes up in the morning, it's an empty castle. And he goes out, gets on his horse, which is left there, saddled and everything, with his lance beside it. And as he rides over the bridge, the bridge is suddenly drawn, and a voice cries after him, "Go on, you goose." And off he goes, wondering what he did wrong. He has failed because he has obeyed the rules of the day instead of the order of his nature. Now, that's the whole crux of the Grail problem. Now, how does he get back again? The rule of the Grail castle is, once you have failed, you get no more chances. The rule of the castle is, you must spontaneously do the thing that was to be done, namely, ask the question of compassion. Instead of holding yourself according to the rules of life as represented by the society, you must act according to nature. The enchantment which is to be broken is the enchantment of the social order. Well, there's a rather amusing scene that follows. He rides away, he is desolate, and he comes to a forest where he camps. Arthur's court, meanwhile, has gone forth to find who this fellow is that's sending all these knights in, whom he has defeated, and they're camped not far away. A hawk flies from that they are falconing out with falcons, and one of the falcons flies away and goes to where Parsifal is. Next morning, there's snow on the ground. The falcon flies after a goose, and a flying goose, and strikes it, and the blood of the goose falls on the soil. And when Parsifal sees the blood, he's on his horse, sees the blood on the soil, he becomes infatuated with it. It reminds him of the red cheeks of his Kandwiramur on the snow-white body. So he's in meditation on Kandwiramur, his wife, when the court wakes up and sees this strange knight out here. Three knights ride at him as he's standing there, and he's so lost in contemplation he doesn't even know they're coming. But his horse does. And just automatically, he pulls his lance off, and the knight who's come after him is knocked to pieces. Finally, Gawain comes and sees him, and he thinks, perhaps he's in love. I've been in love a lot of times, and that's the way people behave that way. So he just took a little silken scarf and threw it over the blood, and Parsifal comes out of it, looks at him, and is very graciously greeted and brought to court. They have a great celebration for him there. And while he is being welcomed in the Arthurian court, the Grail messenger comes, Kundry, Wagner's Kundry. She abuses him as the worst scoundrel in the world, abuses the whole court for having received him. And he departs in shame. And he renounces God. Because he thought he was behaving as a knight of God, and God had rejected him. So he says to Gawain, his companion, when Gawain wishes him well and Godspeed, he says, I have nothing to do with God, and you better hadn't either. Think more of women than of God, and off he goes with that. So, as a outcast from the church, self-outcast from the whole system, social, religious and everything else, he wanders for 5 years in the desert. Meanwhile, Gawain starts on his quest, not knowing he's on it, to release the castle of marvels, the castle of maidens, the castle of women. This is a transformation into a medieval form of the old image of the Isle of Women, which is a very important motif in Celtic romance. It is the Isle of the Dead, and anyone who goes there can't return. Well, Gawain is riding along, and he comes to a spring beside which a beautiful woman is seated, the Orgeluse. Now, he's the philanderer of the world. He sees this woman, and he says, do you mind if I stay a while? You are absolutely the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And she says, well, I certainly know I am the most beautiful thing you've ever seen, but I don't appreciate compliments from idiots. Go on. The further away you are from me, the better. Well, he says, ready or not, I am your servant, and whether you maltreat me or treat me nicely, you are handling your property. I'm it. And she sends him on a number of terrible adventures, always telling him that each one's going to be worse than the last, and indeed it is. But he comes out of it in pretty good case. The final adventure she gives him is to get that castle back, to disenchant the castle. Well, he starts this adventure of disenchanting the castle. I'm telling you this because of what the prime adventure is. The prime adventure to disenchant that castle is to survive the ordeal of the perilous bed. In full armor, he must sleep a night on this bed. Well, it doesn't sound too difficult, except that he comes into this great marble room, and in the middle of it is the perilous bed. And he tries to walk on the marble, and he's slipping in his armor with his shield and everything else. And every time he touches the bed, it runs away. And he touches it again, and it runs away in another direction. Finally, he decides to jump on the thing, and indeed he does, in full armor, plop on the bed. And no sooner does he do that than it starts bumping around and hitting all the walls, and then suddenly a lot of arrows come in on him, and he's got the shield, and then a lot of bolts. And one thing, when Heinrich Zimmer was interpreting this, he gave it the interpretation that stays in my mind. He says, this is a symbol of the feminine temperament as experienced by the male. But Gawain has had a good deal of experience of this temperament, and he knows how to stay with this bed. No matter how irrational and arbitrary the whole thing seems, he's perfectly willing to acquiesce in whatever it wants and does, and finally, indeed, he's been terribly wounded by all kinds of lions that have pounced on him and everything else, and finally, in a state of complete exhaustion from all that's happened, he seems to be dead. And then the door opens and a little girl peeks in and wonders if the knight is dead. And she holds a bit of feather to his nostril, and there's just a little trickle of air coming in and out, so he's alive. Well, the girls rescue him, and as Simmer says, if you can survive the ordeal of the perilous bed, the glory of womanhood comes to you in all kinds of wonderful ways. And so it did to Gawain. Well, it was through this act and a number of other great deeds, but this is the key one, that he released the enchantment of the Castle of Marvels. So he's now won his woman, Olga Lewes, and there's going to be a marriage. To get back to our main hero, Parsifal, he has renounced God. He comes in the course of his strolling to a hermitage. The hermit is not an ordained priest. He is the brother of the Grail King, who has simply gone into the forest to practice the life of meditation. Now I must tell you that at this time, in the 12th century, late 12th century and early 13th, there was a very great monk named Joachim of Flores. That's an L. Who had announced what he said were the three ages of the spirit. The first age was the age of the Father or the Old Testament. This was the spirit communicated to a single people. The second was the age of the Son, Father. The age of the Son, or the Church, the gift of this people given to the world. The third, which is about to appear, to occur, is the age of the Holy Ghost, of the Spirit speaking directly to everyone without any church. But being a monk, he declared that this was going to be an age of hermits, or monastic period. It was thought that St. Francis of Assisi, who lived at exactly this time, was the initiator, the beginner of that age. The Franciscans picked this up. And so the idea of the hermit life as the life that is going to supplant the life of the church comes in as a dominant motif in this period. This is what Treveret sent. This hermit represents the hermit life, not the ordained churchly hermit, but one, just any man who goes into the forest, just as the marriage of Conduermos and Parsifal was unsanctified by the church, so this hermit. Parsifal comes and he asks for shelter, and the hermit takes him in, and the hermit gives him comfort, and Parsifal says, well, I just have to tell you, I hate God. I despise God. He's been mean to me. So the hermit says, and here's the great new doctrine for the church, don't be an idiot. He says, God has love in response for love, and hatred in response for hatred. If hatred is all you've got to give, hatred is all you're going to get. And if love is what you have to give, love is what you will get. And then he says, now read the old stories with a new eye. This pleased me. There's the story of Adam born from the virgin earth, and there's the story of Jesus born from the Virgin Mary, these from the virginal soul, and you also must think of yourself in the light of these great heroes of love and giving and so forth. Well, it touches him, and he goes off, and gradually he's reconciled to God. He comes back to religion, but not the religion of the church, not the religion he was taught. It's a total transformation, the direct communication of the individual to God. Well, I don't want to go on with the rest of this. It goes on and on and on, more than to give you the final touch. There is a great wedding in Gawain's castle. He's going to marry the Ogaluz, and Parsifal is there, but his wife, Condwearmoors, isn't. And the text says there were pavilions, there were plenty of girls available, and he's looking around, and everybody has his girl, and there would have been plenty for him too, but he's thinking of Condwearmoors, and he thinks, when my heart is there and my eyes are here, there is a sort of disequilibrium. I will take my eyes away. So he goes riding away from this wonderful party because of his integrity of love for Condwearmoors. By the way, Trevor Center told him you can't go back to the Grail Castle once having made a mess of it. He said, I am going back, and I am going to get it. The rules are it'll happen only once. Parsifal says, I'll get it anyhow. And having ridden away, he encounters coming toward him a glorious Oriental knight. Now, I must tell you that this Oriental knight is his half-brother. Parsifal's father had had an Indian, a Hindu wife before he married Parsifal's mother. And his son by her was this knight who was coming to him, whose name is Fairfees. The two meet. They don't know who they are. This is the brother battle motif. They are in fierce combat. Neither has ever met such a knight before, when Parsifal's sword breaks. And the pagan knight says, well, there's no honor to me for killing a man without a sword. So he throws his own sword away, and the two sit down to rest. The Muslim says, what's your name? And Parsifal says, why should I tell you my name? And Fairfiz, who's older than he, says, well, I'll tell you mine first. My name is Fairfiz. And Fairfiz the Angevin, and the Angevin, rather. And Parsifal says, well, I'm the Angevin. Well, then they find they have the same, probably have the same father. They remove their helmets, and the descriptions that they've heard of each other match. So they come back to the castle. Before they come back, Fairfiz says, why don't you come see my army? I've got a terrific army here of 98 different nations. None speaks the language of any other, and he's quite an Oriental boy. And Parsifal says, well, the castle of Gawain's just around the corner here. And Fairfair says, are there any women there? And Parsifal says, there sure are. So they go. Now, the thing about Fairfiz is that his complexion is mottled of black and white, which no one has seen such a complexion before. So when he arrives, he becomes the idol of all the women. Parsifal says probably because of his complexion. And, well, one way or another, because of the integrity of Parsifal's love for Condwearmoors, which took him through this whole affair, the Grail messenger comes again and says, you are eligible for the Grail Castle. The integrity of his character had changed the rules of the Grail Castle. When Trevor Zent hears of this, he says, by your human act, you have changed the mind of God. He had told him first that God would respond to his love, that God would respond to his hate. He is the initiator. God is a reflex of man, is the thesis here. And, well, Kundry says, bring your friend here along with you, and the two of them go to the Grail Castle together, and the king is healed of his wound, but the king is no longer eligible. It's Parsifal who becomes eligible for the Grail position without the wound. There's the whole story, really. There's more to say, but this is the main thesis. By behaving according to the rules, by being a king by anointment instead of by achievement, the individuals of that world had brought about the enchantment. And the great fool, who didn't know what he was doing, but acted out of his nature, not with intent to achieve anything, but with intent simply to realize the nature impulse of his own soul, He was the Redeemer of the world. Now, this is something I should think would appeal very much to the Esalen community, because as I understand it, this is what you're all trying to do here. Now, let me add just one more theme before concluding. There's another Grail tradition entirely. A Grail tradition that was invented by the monks, representing this idea here. And that is the Grail tradition of which Galahad is the hero. Parsifal of Wolfram is about 1210, 1215. The Galahad story is about 1230. That's the story that was taken over by Malory 2 centuries later for the Morte d'Arthur, and that's the one that most of us know. According to this tradition, the aim is not integrity in heterosexual love and social virtues. It is spiritual purity, Galahad. The word Galahad in Old French, Galahad, means, is taken right from the Bible, where it means heap of witness. Galahad as a witness to Christ. He appears in Arthur's castle, in Arthur's court, on the day of Pentecost. The Grail has been handed down to Joseph of Arimathea by Christ, but not Christ before the crucifixion, Christ after the crucifixion. The point of the Grail castle here is that the church was founded by Christ, physically visible to mortal eyes, to all mortal eyes. The Grail tradition is communicated by Christ risen to eyes worthy or capable of seeing the risen Christ. And so the castle appears only to those eligible for it, whereas the church is visible to simply everybody. I will conclude this talk with just the kickoff to the quest of the Galahad. Arthur's court is seated at table. There's a rule of Arthur, never to start a meal until an adventure has occurred. So they're all waiting for an adventure. And suddenly the Grail appears, covered, however, by a cloth. Sir Gawain, Arthur's nephew, stands up and says, "I propose a vow," after the Grail has disappeared, "that we should all go in quest to behold this Grail unveiled." And they all indeed have decided to start the next day to quest for the Grail unveiled, each to seek it. And here's a line that struck me when I first read it. It's in this wonderful Cistercian quest, Del Saint Graal. The line is this: "They thought it would be a disgrace to set forth in a group. Each entered the forest at that point which he had chosen, where it was darkest, and there was no way or path. Because where there is a way or path, it is someone else's path, not yours. In the course of that quest, whenever one of those knights saw someone else's track and thought he's getting there, followed it, he went astray entirely. Each quested where there was no path. This is a peculiarly occidental motif. I've never heard or thought of anything comparable in the Orient, where you follow your instructions from the guru and do just what he tells. There is no guru here. They meet gurus along the way who point ways, sometimes right, sometimes wrong. But each is questing on his own. Now, this is a motif that is peculiarly European. It is that romantic sense of something to come into being that has never been on land or sea. And what is it? It is the fulfillment of your own personal, intelligible character and destiny, which no one else can do for you. No one can tell you what it is, what it is going to be, or anything of the kind. And that is the one who finds the Grail. Not the one who simply
goes to the church and does what the establishment tells him to do, but has left the village bound, gone into the forest on a path that is no path, on a way that was never walked before, the way of that personal adventure of your own. This is the great myth of Europe, the myth of the Grail. Whether you read it in the way of Parsifal, in the secular quest, where your marriage, your spiritual life is a function of your life, not of what someone tells you to do, and where your spiritual life, if you choose the monastic way, is again going to be that of the individual hermit quest, so to say. I think this is a very telling, a wonderful story. The big question of Ulysses is exactly the wasteland. Now, let us ask ourselves what a wasteland in our world really is. Joyce speaks of the usurpers in his house. Stephen speaks of the usurpers in his house. His house is Ireland. It has been taken over by the British. It is ruled by British law. There's a wonderful little scene in the very first chapter where these three boys, Stephen and Buck Mulligan and Haynes, the Englishman, are at table in that Martello Tower where they live. A little Irish woman comes in with the milk. Haynes is an Englishman over there to get his PhD studying Irish folklore, so he speaks Gaelic. The poor little Irish woman coming in doesn't speak Gaelic. And she pours out the milk to them, and the Englishman starts speaking to her. And Stephen says, "Do you know what the language is he's talking?" And she says, "No, I don't." And Stephen says, "It's Gaelic." "Ah," she says, "they tell me it's a fine language." And this is the signal to Stephen, like the signal of Athene to Telemachus in the Odyssey, when she says, "Your father's house has been taken over by usurpers and plunderers. Go find your father." Stephen there says, "Our whole life has been plundered by people who are seeking economic and other advantages and nothing of ours. And so I'm going forth to find my true father, the true release from this usurper world." But the language thing is rather important there. There is a language that our own nature speaks to our consciousness. This is the language of mythological symbols. It's the language of the actual import of the images that we experience. Where these are translated, however, into a language that is not that of our psyche, but that of economic or political or historical circumstance, our symbols are taken away from us. This is my thesis having to do with the symbologies of the Christian religion. I've said this before. The symbols that should be speaking of the mysteries of our nature are interpreted as though they referred to historical events. The symbol of the virgin birth brings up the question, is a virgin birth physically possible? Could this have happened around 1 BC? What's that got to do with it? The symbol of the virgin birth refers to the crisis of spiritual awakening, translating you from the gross matter of mere nature creature to the spiritual life of an illuminated human being. And so the symbols have been taken away. That leaves a wasteland in that there is a dissociation between our conscious and our unconscious natures. And the way to bring the separation to an end, to conjoin the two again, is to pay attention to our feeling system. Well, throughout the Portrait of the Artist, wherever Stephen, the little boy growing up, whenever he sees something, we hear more about the way he feels about it than about the actual natural continuity of the object. Joyce is more interested throughout that book in telling you what the response of the young man is to the objects that he beholds and to the things that he hears than he is to telling you what their connections are in the world round about. So he is reassociating everything with the psyche of this boy. And since he is being taught not only physical facts, but also the theology of the Roman Catholic Church, the literature of the classical world, and so forth, we're learning what it means to him, what the evaluation is for him personally, and it's that line that he follows, not the academic line of what he ought to think about these things, but his own personal maverick line of quest and judgment. And so this is the chap who's walking along the side of the shore, finally, contemplating the sea. And we have that fantastic chapter that begins with the words, ineluctable modality of the visible, at least that, if no more. Thought through my eyes, signatures of all things I am here to read. And it goes on, the nearing tide, that rusty boot, and so forth and so on. Ineluctable modality of the visible. The visible world, the waves of the sea, cannot be penetrated. You do not know what is behind, and you can never know what is behind the forms that you see. They block you out. They are ineluctable. They cannot be interpreted or penetrated. The word modality suggests form without suggesting substance. All we behold are predicates. All we experience are predicates. We attribute subjects to them. We even attribute a subject to our own thoughts. All we're experiencing is the passage of experience. We attribute continuities and subjects and so forth. So Stephen is trying to penetrate this wall to come to what Schopenhauer, Kant calls the thing an sich, the thing in itself, the substance problem. But he says, ineluctable modality of the visible, at least that, if no more. Is there a substance? It is at least ineluctable. Then he shuts his eyes, and he hears himself walking, cracking shells as he walks on the beach. These shells are that from which life has departed. All that we experience are the shells. The life moment is not what we're experiencing. We experience the effects of a life that has been just past a quarter of a fraction of a minute before, of a second before. And then he says, this sound that comes to me is the ineluctable modality of the audible. We see and we hear. Then he opens his eyes and he sees two midwives come down. He knows the old ladies. They're coming down, and one of them is carrying a bag. And he thinks, what is she carrying in the bag? Some misbirth with trailing navel cord? Then he thinks of the navel cords as representing, as symbolizing causality. Each leads you back to your cause, your mother, and so forth, which leads us back all the way to Eve, who had no navel because she had no mother. So she's the end of the line. And then he says, that's why mystic monks gaze in their navels. And then he thinks of the navel as being a telephone mouthpiece and the cords, a cable line going back to Eve, and he says, hello, Kinch here. So, space, the ineluctable modality of the visible, time, the ineluctable modality of the audible, causality, the causal chain, these are exactly what Kant and Schopenhauer called the forms of sensibility, the a priori forms of sensibility which shut us around and shut us out from the experience of the transcendent, if there is such a thing. Then he looks and he thinks of that question mark there. Out on the waters is a boat with men grappling for something. What they're grappling for is a drowned man who's going to come up on the ninth day or something like that. That drowned man symbolizes the mystery of the substance behind the waves. This is an alchemical idea. The drowned king, the king drowned in the water, calling to be rescued. Now, everybody that we look at, we are separated from, as Stephen was separated from the drowned man. How are we going to break that separation? Is there really a separation? Is there a separation simply an effect of space, time, and causality thinking? And does it really exist? Now these terms that Joyce uses for these, what he calls the Nebeneinander and the Nacheinander, are from Schopenhauer. That's Schopenhauer's language for this mystery. So I'm going to use Schopenhauer, and Joyce uses him also, to speak about this question. Are we really separated from each other? Schopenhauer asked this question. How can it be that a human being can respond to the pain of another as though it were his own, and at the risk of his own life, forgetting the saving of himself, go to save that other? I think of this when I see on television the choppers, those boys going out to rescue chaps that have been shot down, forgetting themselves altogether in that act. Schopenhauer says this is against nature. The character of nature is to defend yourself. And yet, here is this compassion, this experience, which makes one forget oneself, and one can do this spontaneously, as though it were oneself. Schopenhauer asks, how is this possible? And his answer is that it's possible because, in fact, that other and you are one. That the separation is illusory, and your deepest nature knows this other. Compassion is therefore the metaphysical experience. It is an experience of your identity with the other. And that is what I was talking about earlier when I spoke of pity. This is what Joyce means by pity. So Stephen is sitting here, or walking here by the sea, and he thinks of the drowned man out there in the sea. And he thinks, would I have risked my life to save him? Now the character of Stephen throughout the first half of the book, and the character of everybody in the Ulysses, is self-protective. They're all protecting themselves all the time. Each is enclosed in a ring. That chapter ends with Stephen imagining himself going down into the water to save someone, knowing darn well that he wouldn't have had the nerve to do it. Imagining himself suffering, going down there. And then you turn the page, and the next page tells you, Mr. Leopold Bloom. Leopold Bloom is the father in the sea. He is that other one. He becomes in this book symbolic of the other. Bloom is a man, an extrovert. He is rambling around, and his thoughts are rambling around. He's a genial person, very outgoing. In his rambling way, he thinks all the same thoughts, finally, but by the time you get to the end of the book, that Stephen has thought in his very methodical, introverted way. They're poles apart, and yet their ways cross. Stephen extracts himself from society. He holds himself aloof. He's wearing black in mourning for his mother, but that's only symbolic of his removal of himself from the world. Bloom is a Jew in Catholic Dublin, and although everybody respects him and treats him in a genial way, he feels and is the outsider. And so Bloom is the one rejected by others. Stephen is the one who rejects others. And these two separate ones are moving around through Dublin, and their ways occasionally cross. Now the crisis of the book comes in just about the center. They have gone to a maternity hospital where a woman, Mrs. Purefoy, is having a terrible time giving birth to a child. The boys with whom Stephen has gone are medical students, and they've gone for medical purposes to find out and learn more about this. Bloom has gone simply out of human sympathy to find how Mrs. Purefoy is doing. He's the father of children. He has a natural understanding of the thing. The boys are all bachelors and have that kind of locker room language with respect to the problems involved here. I don't know much about doctors, but they must have a different attitude than the suffering father. So Bloom goes to find out about this, and Stephen goes to find out about this, and they're all sitting in this room, this waiting room, talking around. And Stephen has just said something pretty nasty about God and all that kind of thing, and just about that time, a terrific thunderclap is heard. That's the thunderclap that turns up again on the first page of Finnegan's Wake. The thunderclap is the crisis in the middle of Ulysses. It's the beginning of Finnegan's Wake. That is the voice of God. Stephen is one of these people who's terrified by thunder, and he shows that he's terrified. Bloom has compassion on him. This is the beginning of the breakup of the wasteland motif. It's a wasteland because of those hard egos bumping against each other, the hostilities and the animosities. And this cracks Stephen, frightens him, and Bloom tries to console him. That's the beginning of a relationship between Bloom and Stephen. Bloom has lost a son, a little boy, and Stephen might well take his place in a certain way. Bloom's fatherly attitude goes to Stephen. Well, then when they leave the hospital, they go into the brothels, and Bloom follows to protect Stephen, who he thinks is with a bad bunch. And he loses them. They go into a certain place, and Bloom is hunting for them. And he hears somebody playing a piano in one of these houses and guesses that's probably it, and goes in. Well, there are these three prostitutes and the Mother Superior, Mrs. Cohen, who's a Jewess, and Bloom is a Jew, and so there's a funny kind of meeting there. And there's a special little scene of Bloom's degradation, self-degradation before her and all that, where he turns into a little female pig and she becomes a master of pigs and all this kind of, she's Circe again and all this. And then the girls begin reading palms. Now, Bloom's trouble is, the usurper in his house is a chap named Blazes Boylan, who is his wife's tour manager. And he's spending the day with her, and Bloom knows what's going on. And this is on his mind. He's trying to keep it off his mind. And the girls are reading his palm, and they get the idea that he's being cuckolded, and they begin giggling. And Bloom asks, what's the joke? And Lynch, Stephen's friend, makes fun of him. And then Stephen feels compassion for Bloom. All it takes to break and transform this work, this exchange of moments of compassion. With that, there's a whole symbolic business of the world as it now stands, cracking up a kind of Saturnalian disintegration of things. Stephen goes into a kind of ecstasy of drunken madness and so forth, gets into trouble out in the street, is knocked down by a British soldier, and Bloom stands over him, protecting him. The book has simply to do with the breakup of this sense of separation of the two, and they're coming together. Stephen, who has been defending himself all day, lets his hair down in a silly conversation with Bloom, which makes no sense whatsoever. He, who has been the great intellectual, talks about things he doesn't know anything about and isn't trying to defend himself, and Bloom's talking to him, pulls apart, the two come together, and they are erased in their self-protective character. Each of them disappears at the end of the book, as it were, into night. Stephen out into the night of Dublin, when Bloom says goodnight to him, and Bloom goes up to bed and disappears, so to say, into Molly's unconscious. Then we have wonderful Molly. Now, when Bloom gets into bed, it's a wonderful scene. He gets into bed, and obviously there was another person in the bed also. There are crumbs of plum trees, potted meat in the bed, and he dusts these out, and he thinks, now, what do you do about a thing like this? And he runs in thought in a beautifully mechanical way through all the possibilities, traps, suicides, murders, and everything else. And then he finally says, well, who's been hurt? Utter indifference. That's the arrow of Ulysses killing the suitors. Meanwhile, Molly has asked, who was that you were talking to downstairs? And he says it was Stephen Dedalus. He goes to sleep, and she starts that chapter, which is the only one many people have read. The whole line of her lovers, one after another. And presently she thinks Stephen would be good. And then she thinks there's something fine about him that makes the others look rather gross. And she thinks there's something of that fineness in Leo. And so the lovers are killed in her mind, too. She thinks of Leo, her husband, and the first time they were together on Hoth Head under the rhododendrons. And she says, and I said yes, and I said yes, and I said yes. And she ends with an affirmation of the life, which is such a miserable thing. Everything you've read that day has been miserable. And you think, well, this isn't worth living. But there's a level where it is worth living, and both Bloom and she are affirming it absolutely. In their bed, when he brings Bloom into bed, he puts the two of them in bed and turns them into cosmic presences by a device of prose. And there shines above them lights, circles on the ceiling, reflected from the lamp by the bed. And you suddenly realize those circles on the ceiling, reflected from the bed, are exactly the circles in Dante's Divine Comedy, out of which the image of God himself pours, so that these two in the bed are the man-woman image of the personification of the divine. They are one. Stephen is one with them, and the whole thing is resolved in a suggested oneness, which comes actually into being in Finnegan's Wake, where all the characters are one character, where all the women are Anna Olivia Plurabel in her various aspects, all the men, HCE, whose initials mean here comes everybody, in character, and the two together constitute that man-woman unit, which is the image of God on earth. Joyce had this whole series of works, the portrait, Ulysses, and the Finnegan's Wake in his mind at once. By the time he sat down to write the portrait of the arts as a young man, there's every evidence of this. The same motifs run all the way through, and what it shows is actually how a naturalistically interpreted life carries underneath it all these mythological motifs that we've been detecting round about. In my view, Joyce's two great works, Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, are the Purana, the sacred text of this particular century. Everything is right there. The portrait, which I spoke about earlier, is an imitation of the new life of Dante. You can follow it step by step. It's doing all the same things at about the same time. The Ulysses represents the Inferno. There, we have people tied to their own separate passions, separated from each other and tied to their own little egos, with, however, toward the middle, the beginning of a dissolution and opening toward purgatory, toward purging of this. And Finnegan's Wake is the purgatory of Joyce. Let me let you hear something of the first page, so that I can tell you something about how he resolves this whole thing. The work starts with a small letter, and so that's not the beginning of it. The first sentence, or part sentence, runs like this. River run past Stephen Adams from swerve of shore to bend of bay brings us by commodious speakers of recirculation back to Hoth Castle and environs. Since that starts with a small letter, you wonder where at the beginning of the sentence is. The only place you can find it, of course, is at the end of the book. The last half sentence at the end of the book runs like this. Away, it's the river running out to sea, away, alone, alas, a loved, along the, you turn back, river run past Stephen Adams. The book is written in a circle. It is that circling of time which brings back the same thing time and time and time and time again, which is the state, of course, of dream consciousness, where these things are churning, churning, churning. Ulysses was in waking consciousness, we're now in the consciousness of dream.